from the start, and for all the efforts they're making, and of course to all the Psy students, I hope you're all here. But most of all, to welcome Martin Haynault. He's a professor of astrophysics at Cambridge University, and he's going to tell us how supermassive black holes get into galaxies.
Good evening. As Neil said, I would like to share my views on how supermassive black holes get into galaxies that have formed over a decade or two, and that's a question that I will not really answer, and that will not be answered for a while. And I will try to explain why that is still an open question. And I apologize to the astrophysicists. I think I've geared the talk a bit more towards the non-astrophysics community, so there might be quite a bit of a field that you're quite familiar with, and I apologize for this. So I think if we look at black holes, I think what I am interested in is basically what's outside of the black hole, what most people in this institute would probably find out only, the astrophysics of the stuff that eventually might fall into the black hole or may not fall into the black hole. Normally well away from the horizon, nothing on the horizon, nothing on solutions about resolving the singularity, nothing about the quantum theory of black holes. It's really mainly astrophysics. For an astrophysicist, I think what astrophysicists like to do, they like to classify objects in a pretty broad brush way. And I think for astrophysicists, they come basically in two varieties. The ones are what we call stellar mass black holes. And I think these we understand well, we know where they come from. And the other variety we call supermassive black holes. That's the one we see at the center of galaxies. And there's quite a difference in mass scale between the two. What we don't know is if the mass range in between is well populated too. I think I don't want to say there aren't any, but we are not sure if intermediate mass black holes are really exist in large abundances. So I will first explain you a bit about what we know about the growth of the bigger variety. But before I do that, just a quick word on the stellar mass ones. I think we know very well from calculations of stellar structure and evolution that massive stars above a certain mass end up as black holes. So stars normally don't end up with the same mass they start off with. So you have to discriminate between an initial and a final mass, but above a certain initial mass, apart from a certain mass range, where the star explodes maybe without leaving a black hole, the normal end state is a stellar mass black hole. And we have detected stellar mass black holes up to 100 solar masses. And we suspect that that might actually go on to even more masses, but probably not more than a few hundred. And for the next while of the talk, I will talk about the bigger black holes in the range from nearly a million solar masses to as large as 10 billion solar masses, so that you have more than the mass of a small galaxy just in one black hole. So the way you study these in astrophysics are two basic methods that were very simple. The one thing, you just consider the black hole as a simple B potential well. So you look at signatures in your mass distribution where the motions become very large. So astrophysical objects normally are of the nature that the velocity dispersion across an object is very constant, and if anything, it's falling to the center. And the telltale sign of a deep potential would be that things start to move fast as you go to the center, and that's a basic method, or one of the basic methods, how astrophysicists actually claim to have detected black holes. The other one is that material can fall into black holes. Normally it does that with a lot of angular momentum, so the gas settles into a disk. The typical temperatures of these disks are around 100,000 Kelvin, so they have a peak in the ultraviolet. And the luminosity, you can relate to the accretion rate as a simple function that it's just a certain fraction of the rest mass energy that's released. And that's typically 10%, might be a bit more if the black hole is rotating, might be a bit less if the material doesn't get, if the radiation doesn't get efficiently out. So our best evidence for a black hole is actually at our own galaxy. So I will take you now first to the evidence that at our own galaxy that there is really a black hole.
And you will at the end probably say, oh, what you have detected is the B potential well, and I won't deny that, but I want to tell you a bit more about that B potential well in our own galaxy. And the big progress in all that field over the last decade is mainly driven by advances in technology, so that the observations have become really orders of magnitude better in quality of the data, and the simulations, I would claim, have become quite a bit better too. So for the galactic center, I think on the other side of the Atlantic, what the main workhorse is now the VOT. So what helps is a large telescope, because what you want is high resolution, and for that you need a large telescope. The other thing, what's more important, is that the instrumentation has advanced an awful lot. So there are now very nice spectrographs and imagers that actually exploit the diffraction limit of a large telescope. And what helps there is something what's called a laser guide star, and that looks a bit like Star Wars, and it is actually a leftover from the vision of one of the former American presidents, that he wanted to shoot down missiles. And the problem there is that you have to get the lasers through the atmosphere, and for that you have to basically find a method to correct for the what astronomers are called seeing, what's the turbulence of the atmosphere that blurs your pictures otherwise. And that has been developed by the military, and the military has been far advanced, and that at some stage was declassified and gave a real boost to the same application in astronomy, and has led to much sharper pictures in astronomy. And this is not a cartoon, that is a real laser going out from the telescope, looking at the galactic center. So what you see here is the Milky Way, and the Milky Way is very dusty at its center. There's a lot of dust clouds that obscure the view. And what you do, therefore, is that you look in the near infrared, where the optical depth is much smaller, it becomes smaller than one, and the things become transparent. So that's a view of the galactic center, where with very high spatial resolution, you can start to resolve individual stars, and you get so fine that you can resolve the orbits of individual stars around the center of the galaxy. So initially, people would have thought there shouldn't be much bright stars at the very center, because it's the brighter stars are the younger stars, and it's very difficult to form stars close to a black hole because of the tidal forces. So it came as a surprise when people did that experiment, that some of the stars that they see moving, and they will start to move in a second, actually were in so close orbits that the orbits are closed on a human life span. So most people would have thought the stars that are closest in that you might be able to see would be on so wide orbits that it takes a long time to get around. And when people found the first stars, said for this it wasn't the case, it was this real excitement. So there's a little movie, and what you see is really the stars moving at the galactic center. And initially, it could have gone on an orbit very wide, but it turned out that one of the stars we have really observed going completely round on a period of 12 years. What that helps you is, if I have a system of stars going around a point mass, I can calculate the mass very well. And that's the reason why we're so confident that there's a very deep potential well at the galactic center. So if you do that exercise, so that's the orbit of the star in a little bit of detail. So if you do that exercise, you can work out what the enclosed mass is. And I'm missing one slide here. Sorry. Just a second, I think. This one I'm looking for. So if you do that exercise and work out the orbits in detail, you find that there's an enclosed mass that becomes constant, what is a telltale sign of that you don't have an extended mass distribution anymore, and you home in on a mass of a few times 10 to 6 solar masses. So there's a several million solar mass black hole at the center of our galaxy. You might argue that is not really a sign of a black hole, that is just a deep potential well. So if I tell you the fastest velocities that have been observed there of the order of 10,000 kilometers a second, So it's not yet the velocity of light. So you're not really close to the horizon yet. You're still about a factor 3,000 to 10,000 away from the horizon. So we have just detected a B potential well. But there's no alternative explanation of an astrophysical object that would be that compact, would be stable over cosmological time scale, and could there mask as a black hole. So the astronomers have basically run out of possibilities to explain that other than by a black hole. If you want to get closer to that, you can't much closer to that, you can't use stars, and your best bet is that you use X-rays. The X-rays can come from the deepest part close to the black hole, because there the energies that you have from moving particles become so high that they correspond to X-ray temperatures. And there's few objects where you see gravitational redshifted lines that where the redshift is of order unity. And there the idea is that redshift of order unity is really due to the gravitational redshift, and that there you see radiations that come from within a few Schwarzschild radii. And that's your best bet, probably as close as you can get to the horizon, this observation at the moment. So you might want to get even closer with at the end if you find the right object. And there are ideas to map things in the radio where you might actually see the shadow of a black hole due to the very strong gravitational lensing. And there is some prospect that you really get to maybe 2 or 3 Schwarzschild radii of a black hole that way. I think astronomers, meanwhile, have just accepted if they see a potential well that deep, that is a black hole. And from then on, I will just use the term black hole for deep potential wells, the things that these are black holes. I think the other thing that's happened is that we have now good data for a large number of galaxies that's not our own. And that's mainly thanks to the Hubble telescope. The Hubble telescope doesn't have that problem that it has to look through our atmosphere. And that's the reason that it has higher resolution without actually having these laser guide stars. And that has allowed the measurement of the velocity dispersion of stars very close in a handful or 2 or 3 handful of nearby galaxies. And what turned out when people then looked at the masses of these black holes and tried to see how they relate to the galaxies in which the black holes are sitting, then they found that they are very distinct correlations. And the one very famous one is that the mass of the black hole goes as a power law with the velocity dispersion of the stars, where you can see the velocity dispersion of the stars as a measure of the potential well of the galaxy further out. And we have that now for a reasonable large number of galaxies. And that has given the field a large boost too, because it has given confidence that we see black holes in most galaxies. And then you can go on and study large samples of galaxies and see actually how these black holes grow and how they relate to galaxy formation. So the picture now is that if we look at galaxies, is that supermassive black holes sit in every galaxy that has what we call a bulge. So as you know, galaxies come in two varieties, two basic varieties, the ones that are more spherical, and we call that a bulge, and the ones that are more disc-like and might have a bulge in the middle of the disc. And then there are fuzzy, irregular galaxies too. And it turns out that it seems to be this bulge component of stars that's related to how black holes grow. So the black hole mass seems to scale with this mass of the bulge in these stars. And in every galaxy that has a bulge, so far we have found one.
With the mass of the bulge is tighter or with the velocity dispersion?
Initially, people claimed it was tighter with the velocity dispersion. I think that's disputed.
Okay,
so there is a claim, but it's a sample of 20, 25 objects, and it's not obvious. I think it might well be that it's just a mass-mass relation. People made a big deal out of physical models, coupling it to the velocity dispersion of stars. I've written papers on that myself. I'm not really convinced that that is actually in any way tighter than with the mass of the.
You struck out the word possibly, the dwarfs.
Yeah, because there are now a few dwarfs where we have found it. So that slide has evolved this time. So initially, it wasn't obvious, but there are now a few dwarf galaxies where there's no doubt that there's.
Because globular clusters have a master migration one and two, so they don't have dark matter. Mm-hmm. Whereas dwarfs have very high master migrations. Maybe they have a black hole sitting in there that causes the large halo background.
As you know, I think a black hole would have a capillary profile for the rotation velocity, for dwarfs they have just the opposite. I think dwarf galaxies actually seem to have less dark matter at the center than they should have. So they don't have, the rotation velocity is not rising of any trace. That's actually the opposite. It's actually, we have to explain why there isn't enough dark stuff at the center. So they have a lot of dark matter, I agree. But there you just want to put your black hole, that's where they don't have any dark matter.
They're also subject to large tidal.
And the reason why I make that point is because later I will explain that we think that galaxies form that way from small to big. And obviously we said there's an idea how you get the black holes too, but the question is how you get to the stellar mass ones and how far you can start on the right hand side to actually draw your black hole. So it will be a little bit of a scene later in the talk. Yeah.
You showed how you measured the mass of the Milky Way galactic black hole. How do you measure the mass for other galaxies?
Now for the ones where you look at the stars, you then what you look at is you look at the velocities of the star as a function of radius, and then you have to make a model for the galaxy with all its orbits. And normally, as I said, galaxies are what we would call isothermal, so the velocity dispersion of the stars is pretty flat. If anything that starts to fall as it goes to the center, and if things start to rise, that's normally a sign. That's then taken as a sign that there must be some extra mass that causes these extra velocities. And people do that with detailed modelings of the stars, if you look at stars, or detailed modeling of the gas if you look at gas. Sometimes you look at the gas disk. So there's, for example, a very nice gas disk in one galaxy where we know that there is a black hole, and there's amazing going on that traces the gas motions very well. And they used to see very nicely capillary fall off. So that's the second best individual case. But now you have a few, I think there's not so much leap of faith anymore to believe that the other ones is right. Too much. So for a long time there was a discussion if they are there at all. But once you have taken the confidence that they are generally there, you're getting less critical in this sense. And occasionally you might get the masses wrong. But I think the masses have dramatically improved. And you can only look for consistencies. So sometimes they're determined better, sometimes they're less well. The other thing what has largely improved in astronomical data sets is just the sheer size of the data sets. So we know a lot more about galaxies in general, and we have much better, much more homogeneous data on that. And the one survey that was really instrumental in that was the SDSS survey, and that has taken a million galaxy spectra and 100,000 QSO spectra. And why that had such a large impact on the field is because these have been done taken in a very homogeneous way, and you get homogeneous data sets now that you can split and you can look for correlations with environment, with redshift, with all sorts of things. So you get the imaging, but more importantly, you get for every galaxy and every QSO, you get a spectrum. And what that allows you is, for example, that you can measure now stellar masses from the spectra very well. And you have suddenly samples of 100,000 galaxies, but for each of these you have a stellar mass. And that was just not the case before Sloan was around. And the other quantity is, for that purpose, not so important. This case it's metallicity, but I just wanted to show that there are very large differences where you measure important quantities reasonably well. And for the black hole mass, people have now gained so much confidence that they can claim that they measure the black hole mass is not only in nearby galaxies, but in distant galaxies that accrete. And the way they measure it there is a virial estimate of the mass. And what they do there is they take the velocity bits of certain lines, and these things come from close of the black hole. And then in nearby galaxies, they calibrate the relation between at which radius these clouds should be sitting for a given luminosity of the object. And then you have a radius and a velocity, and that gives you a mass from a virial mass estimator. So there are people who go around and show plots like this, where they claim that they have measured the mass of a few 10,000 AGN. So I'm not so sure if these measurements are still yet free of biases, but I think just the sheer fact that you can do that has changed the field quite a lot. And you shouldn't be mistaken, they're not getting bigger as you go back in time. That's a selection effect. You see brighter objects as you go to higher redshifts, you pick out the more massive ones. So I want now to talk a little bit about what we think about the co-evolution of galaxies and black holes. So we can study black holes out in cosmic time. We can study their host galaxies out in time. And what we think is that these just grow together. And that is reasonably well understood. And I want to just explain a bit what the ingredients of that are. So what you can do now, and again, I wouldn't believe the details of that plot yet, but just the fact that you can do that tells you that a lot has changed in the field. So what people have done here, they have taken the what are called active galactic nuclei, and they have looked how many there are at a given time, and the luminosity from these comes from the accretion of gas. So the gas that's accreted on the black hole should end up in the black hole, and that you can do to model how black holes grow and get a mass function of black hole as a function of time. So that is a function of redshifts, as cosmologists likes to do. And early on, that is a mass function that these people got. And the massive ones, in this case, were already there quite early on. And then the whole thing grows. And you can try to figure out which black holes grow in which galaxies. So this is a what?
Now that is basically based on data, and it's basically using the continuity equation. So you see how much is falling in, you start with the population. There's no unique solution to that. And even though the samples have become bigger, you're not always comparing like with like, you're doing it at a different redshift. So there are many ways of doing that, and that's the reason why I wouldn't put my hand on this particular plot. But I think we can do that in principle now, and I don't think there will be many mysteries hidden. I think it's just there are lots of people working now. It has become an industry now. And it's just a matter of time and even more data to really piece that together, what grows when in which galaxies. On the other side, there was a lot of progress on the modeling side too. So on the more fundamental side, we know now the cosmology in which we live in. And we have measured the underlying matter power spectrum reasonably well for all purposes. We don't know where it comes from. We don't know what dark energy is. But for an astrophysicist said, for this kind of modeling, really doesn't matter. He just wants to know what's there, and it helps to know what's there. And that has taken a lot of the ambiguity, that you don't have to argue always what actually the parameters are, how much dark matter there is, how the power spectrum looks like. And as you know, I think the power spectrum of CDM is of the kind that the fluctuations become larger as you go to smaller scales. That means small objects form first, and large objects grow by merging of smaller objects. So you start off with the first structures that go nonlinear, and these then afterwards start to merge into larger and larger structure. At the present time, the largest nonlinear structures are of the size of galaxy clusters that contain about 1,000 big galaxies. And what's going on with the dark matter, we know very well. And what we have now to figure out is what the galaxies do in this kind of background and what the black holes do too. But I would claim, even so that people can argue forever about some of the details, I think the basic picture is established. And I don't think much will happen there and change that picture. So you can now play games and put either with numerical simulations or with Monte Carlo simulations, you can model that. Put the gas into these dark matter halos and look at the growth. And that's from one model that I did with someone else some years back. And then you get that these black holes grow by a mixture of infalling gas and by merging with other galaxies. And in this particular model, we have just started at a certain redshift with 10 to the 6 solar masses. And it will become a little bit clearer why we did that and why the actual uncertainties in that game lie on this side, that we don't know how to get there. I think the rest, I think we will eventually figure out. And there are more and more people working on it, and the field doesn't get more pleasant.
That's
just the mass of the black hole in the galaxy. And these are other black holes that fall in.
So it's this kind of merger tree, and what I'm now putting in is gas and black holes, and do a model for galaxy formations that I afterwards compare with observed quantities. And that is a model that, meanwhile, there's a whole industry of people doing it, and you have then lots of observable what you can do, you have lots of freedom too. And I think in principle, that's what's going on, but in practice, you would like to do a full, you would to simulate the full physics. What's going on there is that this black hole is sitting there, then here's another black hole falling in, and creates a little bit of gas, and it's a mixture of gas falling in and black holes falling in. And at the end, they grow more by just merging of black holes, because we know that the galaxies get the gas poor. So if you want to set up a model like this, you better do it that way, that the galaxy in the end are gas poor. And if you want to do that properly, you put the physical effects in that actually lead to gas poor galaxies in the end.
So most of the mass comes from other black holes?
No, most of the gas comes initially from accretion of gas.
Sorry, most of the mass of the final black hole was due to
accretion
of black holes or gas?
No, it's probably 80% that is accretion of gas. Yeah. It depends a bit on the mass. For the most massive ones, they are dominated by merging at the end.
Merging of
black holes. Yeah.
Did I understand from that plot that in the late stages there tend to be solar mass black holes that are falling into the black hole that you're modeling?
Yeah.
Could you go back one?
Yeah, there might be even 10 to 9 solar mass one falling into a 10 to 10 solar mass one.
And so. Where do they grow? Because those must also grow by a similar process.
They all probably start in smallish galaxies as a million solar mass black hole. Let's decide now how you get that million solar mass for a while. There's gas falling in. Initially, there's lots of gas around. And so in each galaxy, they grow a lot, maybe 3 E-foldings. Then they have a merger, another one comes in. There's new gas falling in. They grow 3 E-foldings again by just gas. Later on, the gas is consumed in most galaxies for reasons that's complicated astrophysics. So then I will only have mergers of black holes. And there are systematic effects at the most massive ones. In the end, we'll just grow another factor of 5 or so just by merging of black holes. And we know now enough about galaxies and how they get their gas that we can say this basic picture is right. What people argue now about is in which galaxies they grow by how much. How much is done in mergers and how much is in between. And but I think the basic picture, I think, is... I will show a few more pictures that might convince you. That's our picture. So what you therefore have a lot, and that's what people here like a lot, is that these things merge, and that is probably our best route to study strong gravity. So when these galaxies merge, what the black holes will do is it will fall to the center of the new galaxy. So it will form a binary. That binary can harden either by scattering out stars. That becomes after a while difficult because you have to have stars with low angular momentum that actually get close enough for hard binary that becomes very difficult, or by dynamic reflection in gas and bring the things together. And then they're very close, they will spiral together by gravitational waves. That because the gravitational wave time scale depends so strongly on the separation, because the lowest multipole is a quadrupole that you can have. It's only at the very late stages and then very quickly. But the basic picture actually favors that there are lots of mergers with galaxies, so that shouldn't be a rare event. And there was a long debate in the field for a while if black holes actually get hung up at a certain stage if they merge, or if they get close enough to the regime, they have gravitational radiation. So initially they come back together fast, but then there's a gap here. If I do it by a scattering of stars, I run out of the stars, said I have a small enough angular momentum to go to the very center of the familiar city. So the time scale shoots up. So you have to repopulate these lost cones. And there was a long debate if that's possible on the reasonable time scale. But there's now general agreement that for the smaller galaxies, that shouldn't be a problem. And there should be lots of mergers, and there should be lots of gas too. So people think that the black holes should generally merge too. So there should be lots of effects. There should be lots of these mergers to observe. Since this merging is not only interesting for the for gravitational wave radiation at the end, I think it turns out that it's very interesting for galaxy formation itself too. And a lot of the progress there was in numerical simulations that tell us a bit about what's going on there. And that has been a very influential work that Volker Springer has done. And what he has set up there is two gas-rich spiral galaxies that merge. He has put black holes at the center and put some of the physics in. He has put the accretion of the gas onto the black hole in a simplified fashion. More importantly, he has put the energy output that the black holes do on the galaxies into these. And you will see what happens is a simplified version of what you can later simulate in the cosmological simulations. So these black holes do merge, and you have tidal effects, and some heat. That's just the gas density. That's hydrodynamics. So it's gravity, it's the gas physics. So there will be shocks in the gas. And what's in there, that is a black hole each of them. And when the black hole grows, it puts a lot of energy out. And then you see a wind that's blowing off the gas out of the galaxies. And that's probably an extreme version. And what you don't see in that movie is the stars. So there's a galaxy around there, and the stars you don't see. So that's just what's happening to the gas. So that's the whole thing you should imagine is happening in an environment where in the end you will end up with one of these stellar bulges. And you might imagine why that you need really numerical simulations to simulate that. That's not something what you easily estimate what's happening in detail, just this analytical calculation. So that is just to show what kind of progress there was to simulate these kind of processes. So that's a sequence from the same simulations where you have this merger, you have the tidal effects, these are tidally torn gas that comes out. You have the effect of the black holes growing. Once they're above a certain threshold, they blow the gas out. This is an actual picture of two merging galaxies that are observed, just to convince you that that's something was actually happening. So that's not just computer games, but that's, you really see that. I think in astronomy, you have just the problem that you only see one of these pictures at a time, and many of these are difficult to see. So you even see that looks very prominent, that would actually mainly come out in the X-rays, and it's not easy to see that, and it doesn't and it takes not very long too. This is another picture to convince you that these mergers are frequent. So what you see here is two galaxies, and these two galaxies have actually merged, have black holes that put out jets. So these are very collimated gas streams. And that normally happens only for a small fraction of the galaxy's lifetime. So it's very rare to catch two of them doing it at the same time. It's not quite accidental, because when they get closer, it's more likely that they do it. And this is two of these black holes that in the end will merge and will form binary. And observationally, what was very important is that we actually see these effects of the energy put out of the black hole on their environment. So when people got better X-ray satellites, they could look at higher resolution, and they could look at galaxy clusters. Galaxy clusters are very good for that, because they can confine the energy that the black hole puts out, and you can really see the energy of these jets working on the environment. So what you're seeing here is a hot X-ray gas in a galaxy cluster. There's a galaxy with a black hole sitting at the center that has these kind of jets coming out, and this blows these kind of bubbles into the galaxy cluster, and we believe that that is an important part of the thermal cycle of this galaxy cluster that prevents the gas from cooling at the center. And there was a long-standing problem that galaxy clusters should have cooling flows, and in the end it turned out that the cooling flows were not observed, and people believe now that's because the black holes put the energy in to offset the cooling, so that there's a delicate balance between cooling and heating in these. And if you look into these bubbles, into the radio for these jets of these quasars, that's this kind of what it looks in the radio, and that fits just perfectly into these bubbles. So people think that they understand that quite well now. And I think this I will probably go through very quickly, because I'm running out of time. Want talk a bit about what I'm doing at VN2. So you know that your fired people can actually calculate these mergers, and that is very promising that you actually learn something about strong field gravity that way. So the interesting bit for galaxy formation is that these merger calculations of black holes predict that black this doesn't happen completely symmetric, but that the black holes get a kick. And as you know, it has been decades till people could do these calculations. And the first calculations that came out were for non-spinning black holes, and there the kicks were order of 100 to 300 kilometers a second, and that's just of order the velocities in galaxies. So that was very interesting immediately, because it means that black holes, when they merge, get a kick that corresponds to the depth of the potential well they're sitting in, so they can shake them up and make them moving. It got even more exciting when people were able to do spinning black holes, because they got configuration where these velocities that you get at the mergers were as large as 4,000 kilometers a second. That's larger than even the biggest escape velocity from the biggest galaxy. So you could kick out the black holes altogether. And that obviously should have some implications. I will skip that too. So what I've said so far was basically that we understand this growth of the black holes quite well. We know now a lot about galaxies. We know when gas falls in, we can make plot like these. So if we would know how to get a million solar mass black holes, then with a bit more work, we would be done. So it's an interesting phenomenology. You have these merging black holes, they're kicked out, they're kicked around. So there are lots of people to do for doing nice simulations, but I think the basic picture is in place. So what we want to know now is how do we get these small black holes in the first place? Because I think that's still a serious problem. So I will take the rest of the talk concentrating on that question. So how do these million solar mass black holes form in the first place? So could you, for example, assume that you start just with stellar mass black holes and grow them up? And I will argue that that's very unlikely. And I think where you probably should go to get a handle on that problem is you should have a look at the most massive black holes at the earliest time where you see them, because these are the most difficult to form. And if you look at high redshift quasars, the highest redshift quasars we find are between redshift 6 and 7. That's at the time when the universe was less than a billion years old. And yet at that time, we can estimate the mass of these black holes to be already several billion solar masses. So even that early on, we have already very, very massive black holes. And as I will explain a little bit, this is a bit of a puzzle. And it's not so much of a puzzle that we wouldn't think that we couldn't form a galaxy that early, because we have this nice cosmological model. We can work out how many massive halos you should find at these redshifts. And these black holes actually have the decency to be not too abundant. They have surveyed more or less the whole universe to find them. So they have a very low space density. So if I look at this plot where the space density would lie, it would lie down here. If I go to redshift 6, I would still have a very decent post-halo available for that. So there are already dark matter halos fully collapsed at redshift 6 that have a solar mass of several 10 to 12 solar masses. So they should not have a problem in principle hosting a 3 billion solar mass black hole. The problem comes about from something else. I think black holes normally don't degrade arbitrarily fast. There's something what's called the Eddington limit. So if I try to stuff black hole, if I try to stuff things into a black hole, it normally likes to resist, a little bit like small children. And
have you tried putting
it in my children? My children are a bit older, but I can tell you they resist it to feed them what they don't want. But
I didn't like black holes.
And the idea there is that the energy that comes out of the black hole pushes things outward. And you can make a spherical argument for that that's very famous and due to Eddington. And it turns out that both the attractional force scales with 1 over r squared and the outward force due to the radiation pressure scales like 1 over r squared. And you get something what's called the Eddington rate, that in the end just scales with the mass of the black hole. So the accretion rate of a black hole at the limit where it pushes the stuff at the same rate outwards as it tries to fall in scales linearly with the mass of the black hole, and it depends inversely on the efficiency with which I turn the accretion energy, the rest mass energy that's accreted, into radiation. So if I make that efficiency very large, that rate becomes smaller. So that defines a characteristic growth time, and that growth time at early times is not so different anymore from the age of the universe. So I get the growth time that's 4.5 times 10 to 7 years. The age of the universe at redshift 6 is less than a giga year. So I have only 20 E foldings if I agree that the maximum rate to actually grow my black hole. 20 E foldings would be just enough if I start at the Big Bang. Probably want to start a little bit later if I want to start with a 100 solar mass black hole to get it up to this mass. So there is a problem there, unless I want to say that I feed at a larger rate, and I think that seems to be not what you normally observe. So you could imagine why that should happen too, but that's normally not assumed, and there are good reasons why not to, both theoretical and observational. So if I want to grow the whole stuff from stellar mass seeds, then I have to assume that I have adequate limited accretion with a duty cycle close to one, so I have to just have the right amount of mass all the time to feed it, or at least overfeed it and the rest goes somewhere else. I have to efficiently grow in very shallow potential wells. So if I go to the smallest masses early on, the potential wells become so shallow that a few stars that go off would blow out the gas. And I think that's the main reason why I think that you can't start a stellar mass black hole. And then you probably have to do some fine tuning too in these early halos. If I would put a black hole and start in every halo, then due to the merging and that kick out of black holes, I would lose quite a few, and that would make an efficient growth probably not possible. Or you could drop this assumption that you can't exceed the Eddington limit, what people are quite reluctant to do. You might get more desperate and allude to primordial black holes instead, and I would say it's maybe not that crazy, because we're struggling now for 20, 30 years to explain that. And if they wouldn't be there, I think people wouldn't think that black holes actually should form that way. I think there's a lot of, we know that they're there, so now we have to find a way to form them. But that should make you a bit wary, because if people try too hard, they might get it wrong. So there might be something else too. And as probably people know better than me, I think there are lots of models that predict primordial black holes. And there's the idea is that it's a certain fraction of the horizon mass that goes into them, and initially they're compensated, but they come very quickly uncompensated because the radiation redshifts away, and so you will end up with actually initially having only a very small fraction of the matter in black holes and can still have a sizable fraction at later times. I think what's not so nice is that you have to get into a parameter space that the people who like these models for primordial black holes find very artificial and fine-tuned. There are observational constraints on that, and you would need at the present day something like a fraction of a percent in primordial black holes. So that's way away from all observational limits that would do, but you would have to center them somewhere here. And you wouldn't like a broad mass spectrum, because then you run into problems on either the one side or on the other side, where these limits come down dramatically. So the early goals of supermassive black hole. So I personally think our best bet is that you start with seed mass black holes, and that's where I talk a bit about work that we have done recently. And that's mainly numerical, where we try to do this process. So that's together with Volker Springer and the postdoc that we have at Cambridge at the moment, Deborah Sujaki, where we try to do the full Mounty and put in a cosmological hydrosimulation and look at that growth of black holes. So for this, you need reasonable sized computers, you need the right computing codes, and you need dedicated grad students. and then hopefully you get where you want.
Unfortunately, they quite often have a mind of their own
and find other problems that
they find more interesting than you find.
But I think you probably have encountered that too. So, so this is these kind of simulations. These are now full hydro simulations, and the black holes are just painted on, but they're really in the simulations. And this is a simplified model for the accretion, and there's a full formulation for what the black holes to the environment too. So that's now a blow off. We have some of these black holes in, and this is a bit of a sheet that's taken from higher resolution simulations, but a more coarse-grained version of the energy input from the accretion onto the gas is all self-consistent in these simulations. So if you do that, and if you start with million solar mass black holes at a redshift of 12, you nicely grow them initially exponentially, then at some stage, they said, I haven't had enough. I don't want to grow anymore. That's when they start to spill, and that's what you've seen in that nice movie from Volker Springer, and from then on, they grow more moderately. And it works out very beautifully that with the assumptions that we think are reasonable, you get to a mass of a few times 10 to the 9 solar mass black holes in the biggest, or in the most massive halos that are around at these redshifts. And to have the dynamic range to model that self-consistently is not quite trivial. So that works out quite well. And
do you assume Eddington accretion or like maximum Eddington boundary?
We assume maximum Eddington.
Maximum Eddington.
So that it's limited to Eddington.
Right.
And there's a simplified accretion model in that Volker and Deborah like to call Bondi Hall accretion. I would just call it an accretion recipe because the Bondi Hall radius is not resolved. It's basically just a recipe for the equation. That's reasonable. I think basically if there's enough gas at the center, it accretes. They have a certain formulation, but that's not what limits. I think it's normally limits.
So my ninth question is, if you apply that criterion, say, to the gas in the center of the galaxy, do you get the right luminosity or right accretion?
Now, center of our galaxy is in a very different regime. So most of the growth happens when there's plenty of gas. But our galactic center is extreme at the end. There's obviously no gas for fueling around.
Well, but the thing is that Bondi accretion overestimates accretion into center of our galaxy. So the question is it applicable in any time?
They just call it Bondi Hall accretion. It's not at the right scale. I think what you can satisfy yourself is obviously you don't resolve the right scales yet. So all what the simulations do is let's assume if there's enough cold gas at the center of these galaxies, they can resolve it. You create it, but not above the event line. So there's this other problem what you alluded to, you have to do separately. So if you can't do, you just don't have the dynamic range to do it in full cosmological simulation. So you just have to admit that.
I think in this regime, the Bondi limit is a lower limit and probably not a very interesting one, actually.
Yeah. As I said, I've discussed that with my collaborators many times. I think calling the Bondi Hall it's just confusing.
Because it's a formula.
It's a formula, it's just a recipe. And all what they're checking is if there's enough gas. And if there's enough gas, they let it accrete. I think everything else just confuses people like you who know about Bondi Hall accretion and then wonder if it's really that. And that's the reason why I think we shouldn't do that. Yeah?
So it looked like you were showing us a cosmological simulation where you put in gas in black holes.
Yeah.
Where do you put the black holes?
Initially, so we started at putting in the black hole with a redshift of 15 or so, that puts them at the center of certain halos. So that is basically our start, and that's what we call seed black holes, and that is a separate problem how you get these, and that will be the last slides I'm showing what I think is our best bet. Why that might be a reasonable thing to do. But
the
you can't do
the
problem
primordial
in one go.
What? If the black holes are primordial, I guess it's not obvious to me that they should be located.
If they would be primordial, then you should place them more randomly. I completely agree. I just throw that in at a point where I thought that you might allude to something else. I'm just basically trying to stick with the astrophysical solution and try to explain you how hard it is.
So then at some stage, you might rather swap the primordial black hole and think the difficulties there might not be as bad as what I presented here.
But even primordial ones would grow halos around.
They would grow it because they're not, they're not compensated, so they would grow by a factor of 100 easily. So they would act as density fluctuations. So they would create some extra, they would basically form some extra dark matter halos that are not in there before. And that wouldn't be difficult to put in either if you really wanted to.
How do you decide the number density of these primordial?
We just pick a certain mass threshold and put them at a certain mass threshold.
How many of them?
One each. But we have played with that. So you can play them and put them in every hundreds. You can play with the mass threshold. And you will find that as long as you don't, you can basically, with these Monte Carlo models, you can basically figure out what you expect for this. And within a reasonable wide range, it's independent of what you do there. If you basically do only one in every million, then obviously it doesn't work anymore. But there's a reasonable wide range where it doesn't make a difference. One thing I have wanted to mention was this plot here. What makes a difference is how fast black holes are spinning. The reason for that is because the efficiency of the accretion depends on the spin of the black hole. If I have a fastly spinning black hole and I accrete on prograde orbits, the gas gets closer to the horizon, gets closer to the black hole, and I get a larger efficiency in terms of radiation versus resonance energy. What that means, if I have fastly spinning black holes, I found it more difficult to grow to large masses because they put more radiation out for every unit of mass than it would be. So the red line here is a model where the black holes are fast spinning, and then for the same assumptions, you find it difficult to get to that big black holes. What these two lines show is that if I start with 10 to 6 solar mass seeds and 10 to 5 solar mass seeds, by redshift 6, the result is pretty much the same. And that's what you had asked, how sensitive to that was. So there's some freedom in what I do, but that leaves me still with a question, how do I get this 10 to 6 solar mass black holes? So there are people who have extended these models out to larger redshift into smaller and smaller mass, and just said, as we merge these halos, we just grow the black holes too. I think that is a gross disregard of what we know about galaxies, because these small halos are very inefficient at forming galaxies. So we know that beyond a certain mass scale of the dark matter halo, a few stars are enough to blow out all the gas. That's the reason why we don't see all these objects in our own local groups that you would predict from cold dark matter. They don't form stars. I think it's easier to form stars than black holes, though my natural inclination would be to assume that these things are not very efficient at getting the gas together and form black holes unless there's something special with them.
The latter CDA model is a page in the universe is about 15.7 kilometers, 14 kilometers. But there are cosmological models with much larger ages.
Mm-hmm.
So to go for them, things would be more comfortable.
I agree, but seems a high price to pay.
What price?
I have to believe that model.
Well, some of us would, yeah.
But no offense, man, but I agree, I think. I probably wouldn't go for that to ask for longer lifetimes. I think people have done that with stars, and in the end, it turned out that people got the range is wrong. So I would rather say then send myself back to the drawing board and say I'm working hard on the astrophysics to make it happen a bit faster before I would go that far to want to change the age of the universe. So what I think, what are the best bet is how these black holes form is that they form massive seed black holes in certain small galaxies at higher redshifts that have some special conditions. And halos that are just have a potential value that corresponds to a real temperature of 10 to 4 Kelvin and a little bit above, they are sort of special. So they're sort of special in the sense that you need atomic cooling for the gas to cool, so molecular hydrogen wouldn't do, but you're just at the threshold where you can do that. And if I have a halo like this, several things could happen. If the gas cools, I would normally form stars. And then it's very hard to form a black hole, but might be possible. Might form then a star cluster, and in the end, I might still form a massive black hole and might get my seed that way. But then we should see black holes in global Lie clusters too, and that's I'm not yet sure about. So it would be very difficult to see there. And there's a lot of debate going on if we see them there, but the pool is still out on that. So once you break up the gas into stars, I think it's harder to do. So I think what I suggest is that the best bet is that you think about conditions where this fragmentation to stars doesn't happen. And these halos, if I don't have H2 and don't have metals, they are probably the best bet how you get the gas into a very compact configuration in one go and might form what might be a very special star, a very special star in the sense that it sits one star at a time in a smallish galaxy and sits under the infall of a lot of gas raining onto it. You might have such a situation if you don't have lots of...
What's the difference between these? Why is one gives you one star and the other gives you lots of stars?
The one has fragmentation, the other doesn't.
Why one has fragmentation?
Because you pick the halos that don't have metals yet, and you pick a halo that's just so located that you have enough UV radiation that it destroys your molecular hydrogen. And what happens then is, so if I have H2 cooling or automatic cooling and have a gas cloud, it normally fragments into stars. If not, you might get into a very compact configuration. So people have done simple simulations of that. So they've taken a halo like this, and then what happens if you put H2 cooling in, so you break the thing up into stars, and then what happens if you suppress H2 cooling, alluding to the source of UV, and that's not trivial. It's not so easy to break up, and it's not easy to have a configuration, but you have a lot of halos to play with. And that actually works very well, and that's where my grad student John Reagan comes in. So he has done very nice simulation, which just simulated exactly that, taking very nice computer code and actually looked how far you can get there. And this is one of these halos that have just a spherical temperature of 10,000 Kelvin. The gas gets 7,000 or 8,000 Kelvin in them. You get a very nice collapse, so you get an isothermal density profile. And the gas very nicely loses the angular momentum and gets to smaller and smaller radii and forms a very compact disk and loses most of the angular momentum. And I know that I'm overrunning now, so I'll do that quickly. So that's a Fuhrman's version of a video. And that's a simulation where you start with a cosmological simulation of one of the small halos. So the scale there is cosmological. So you have these typical filaments. And then you look at one of these male halos and then you just zoom in. And you keep in zooming, and the gas just collapses and collapses, loses angular momentum. And it's probably turbulent angular momentum transport that hasn't been studied in detail yet. And we're working on to see how that gas actually loses the angular momentum in detail. It becomes smaller and smaller, you go past parsec scale. And that you have to go beyond parsec scale until the gas settles in angular momentum support. Here's a little bit of fragmentation that breaks up into two or three objects. And in the end, you form a nice disk that's very, very smooth. So you will quite rightly argue that's not yet a black hole, but that's basically how far we have got. And that's technically not very, it's not easy to do that.
So you dissolve all of the scales?
See, this is the same what I've shown you. It's just how you go down in scale. And it's sometimes I've kept the scale fixed, and sometimes I've changed the time. And what you see is that the gas is basically collapsing, and that's an isothermal collapse. And there's always a gas flowing out here that loses any global momentum and the rest keeps collapsing.
What's the mass?
Of the planet?
So that will be a disk with 10 to 5 solar masses that sits in a halo where there's another 10 to 7 solar masses that's falling onto it. So that could go now on to form a massive star of 10 to 4 or 5 solar masses, in which there's a lot of gas accruing. And the reason why that is a very favorable situation, I think massive stars of that mass are normally unstable. But if there's so much mass hanging onto it, we are in a completely different regime. And that's what people now are studying too. And that seems to me the most promising road to get these massive feedback counts. And I'm overrunning now. So the last two slides were a bit to discuss how will we ever know. And I started my talk with saying that we don't know yet how super massive black holes get in there. And I don't claim that I wanted to convince you that I know now yet. And in the end, I think that question will be settled observationally already. And I think our best bet really is at LISA. And what we can study there is at very high redshift, there's mergers of these small black holes that can actually look at how far down the hierarchy this buildup of black holes goes. I think the depressing thing is that timeline. That's what I was told as a student, as a grad student. So optimistically, I wrote a paper on that. This is how I've changed the slide with the years. That's what I've taken off from the slide. When was it, last Friday?
Yes.
And what you notice is there's normally always, it's about the same time between the actual date and the proposed date. So it's not coming closer yet. But I very much hope that it comes closer before I retire. The better bet in terms of politics might be an X-ray satellite, but not in science. I think that community is perhaps stronger in getting the next big satellite. So these small galaxies you can see by these small black holes you can see by their accretion too. And we've done some simple model what the next generation satellite should see. And they should see black holes out to redshift 8, perhaps 10. The challenge there will be to actually find out which ones are the ones that are actually at these high redshifts.
Yes.
I know it's not politics, so no. I know that they've, but they're politically done very well by the
region. You scaled it down, so you're not going to get that.
Don't make it worse. Okay. It's worse enough anyway.
You can put 2050 down there.
maybe
you will be retired.
You will. And maybe you should vote for LISA instead of IXO, then.
I don't get to vote.
No, but you are the community, aren't you?
I'm in the, yeah.
I like X-ray astronomy too, and we will learn a lot from IXO too, but we might not solve that problem. Let's put it there. And that's where I want to end. And that's the over, and I just put it on my summary slide.
Questions, go ahead.
So I'm sort of wondering, given the pessimism over looking at these things for high redshift expressed, another way of thinking about this is if what you're worried about is variations in how you seed things, then the impression I get is the more seeds you put in, the more seeds you lose in the process of merge. That it's hard to imagine mergers efficiently consuming all your seeds. So do you think it makes sense to go looking for small seeds at low redshift?
I think what hasn't been done as good as you could do is just look at faint X-ray sources at low redshift and see how many small mass black holes there are. Mm-hmm. My suspicion, if you would really do the mass function carefully at low redshift, is you're fooling at small masses. And that would probably already tell you that these small masses, black holes, are just not there in large numbers. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that has been done as well as it could do. Mm-hmm. But I've occasionally try to convince the local X-ray astronomer, but so far not to.
But it's hard to go to a mass function from a luminosity function.
I know.
So you have to make a lot of assumptions, and so that's probably why people are.
But that's what he always says, too.
Right, but that's you go to intermediate.
That's what I mean with you haven't tried as hard yet as you can. I think you should do
it. But the reason is because of your first slide. You have the intermediate mass black hole with a big question mark. Well, you know, there are objects out there that if you assume they're accreting at the Eddington rate, they would, you know, they would be 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 5 solar mass black holes. But you have to make that assumption.
You can see 10 to the 5 solar mass black hole in a low redshift easily. And my gut feeling, looking at the literature, is just that there seem to be fewer than there are 10 to the 8 solar mass black holes.
And if you want to get the tensor 8 solar mass black holes by merging of tensor 5 solar mass black holes, that shouldn't be. But I don't have not anybody seen that actually quantify in a way that that I would not just stay here and wave my hands and claim it. And I agree that you have to make a lot of assumptions, but I think that it's an interesting enough question that I think you should try.
Well, you see them in low mass galaxies, right? So you see low mass galaxies have multiple point sources, which if they are accreting at the Eddington rate would, you know, potentially could grow into larger black holes, although not 10 to the 6 solar mass. There's some evidence.
Yeah, there's no dispute that there's a few small ones, but they don't seem to be whooping up, that everything is dominated by them, and it's not a sensitivity issue. And that's something what I never understood, if that's just because I don't understand, I'm too far from the field to judge if that's just because I don't understand it well enough, that shouldn't be. But naively, I would just expect, if you have the sensitivity to see them, in small galaxies there's lots of gas, then your numbers should be completely dominated by the small guys. That doesn't seem to be the case. Mm-hmm. And I've never seen it quantified if that's a real problem or not. Mm-hmm. So I would say certainly tensor 4 solar mass black hole, there's no doubt about that. But are there many more than there are big ones? I don't think so. And if so, they're in special places, like the ULXs that seem to form in tidal. They really see them forming in star-forming regions. So even if they're in good mass, they're probably not the ones that are at the center of galaxy. Michael?
So in our local group, there are three supermassive black holes, and there are lots of smaller galaxies. Is this a problem, or connected to this problem of the absence of 10 to the 4th solar mass black holes?
We don't have so many.
You think our local group is totally...
we don't have that many bulges at all. In our local group. So Andromeda has a big bulge, a big black hole. We already have a pretty wimpy bulge, a wimpy black hole. And the rest of the galaxies is more of the regular variety. So I don't think we see anything what in that picture would be in any way special.
So there are other groups.
So we have actually a pretty cool group. There's just two big spiral galaxies.
So
the one even has a wimpish bulge.
So there are other clusters of galaxies where, in your answer to the previous question, you would expect to see many black holes that are not seen?
No, I think for the big ones, I think wherever people have looked, they found one. I think it's just the small ones, and they're harder to see. So there are selection effects why that's just scales that way, that in the bigger galaxies they're easier to see. And they're easy, and that's not obvious why, but if you look into it in detail, that's the case. But the X-ray is the one place where that's not the case. So you can actually go very faint, and they can see the small guys to appreciate it, actually.
Maybe this question's already been asked. Why is it we don't see many stellar mass black hole candidates? I know the usual one.
I think we have plenty of stellar mass black hole candidates. I think the best way of seeing stellar mass black holes is again in binaries. There's something what's called cataclysmic variables. That's a creation from one onto the other. There are lots of binaries that have compact objects, and many of them have black holes. And I think there are enough of them. Well, I don't think anybody from the astrophysical community thinks there's any problem whatsoever in terms of that seems.
So you mentioned two types of cooling processes, atomic cooling and molecular / metal cooling. Mm-hmm. And you said one leads to isothermal collapse and the other leads to fragmentation. So what's physically different between these two cooling processes?
What's different is that we have picked these halos that are just sitting at the gas density, the lowest gas density you can cool to by atomic cooling. So this is a halo that has a variable velocity of 10,000 Kelvin. With atomic cooling, you don't go below 7,000 Kelvin. So you're you're basically marginally gene stable. So if I would do the same in a halo that's much more massive, then I could fragment this atomic cooling just the same way as I do with the molecular cooling in these halos. It's basically this match of these temperatures, and that's the reason why these halos are special.
So you're saying they're marginally stable, basically?
They're made marginally stable.
Okay.
It's the variable temperature of the halos basically matched to the minimum temperature of the atomic pulse halos.
But you need a UK background to dissociate the molecules?
You probably wouldn't want to have a background at that time, because you want to do that early and there are not many metals around. But you might, for example, have a configuration where you have two halos, one that has four stars, and it's produced relatively a lot of UV, and then you have another halo that's just next to it, and that just has a special conditions. And because I know you need only one seed for every massive black hole later, I can afford to throw away most halos.
Yeah.
So that would be the idea.
So it's not every.
But that's where basically the hand waving, the desperate part comes in, where it's like maybe you want to rather go to primordial black holes and to look to things like that.
So how do you correlate these seeds with the big halos?
What do you mean by correlating?
So you have this unusual event happening, which forms your 10 to the 6 halo mass black hole. How do you make sure
that? Let's say I do that in every thousandth halo of that mass. They will find them. They will find themselves at some stage just in a bigger black hole. And Martin had a very very nice virtual record space. It's the survival of the fittest. It's the biggest guys at the end are the ones that had the most fuel along the way. And then there's a big selection effect in there. So some of them might be unlucky and might be underfit. But as long as you make don't make them too rare, you will have enough. And initially, there's plenty of cancer now.
Is there any theoretically reasonable model that fits as well the data for the super-Eddington option that you mentioned before? Super-Eddington equation?
Maybe once we know that the Eddington equation happens in collapse houses. So if you have a supernova, the collapse that precedes the supernova, the material there collapses at super Eddington rate. So it's not something that is impossible. But what you have to do is you have to basically have a collapse that's so fast that it traps all the radiation too. And there are analytical solutions for that that Mitch Biegelman has done in the spherical case. But there's some sort of artificial. And as soon as you break the spherical symmetry, the stuff will go out one way and the gas will fall out the other way. And the gas will fall in the other way. So it's not so easy to say how you can have a stable configuration so that you does it in practice, unless you are really violently unstable. And my biggest argument against that being the norm is that we know now the masses and luminosities of many black holes, you can plot them. So we have an idea what the actual occlusion rates are. And they really peter out as you go to the Eddington limit. So there's just observational evidence that that's not what's normal.
So there's no model that speaks.
And that's probably the strongest argument. It's just we just don't see it happen. Otherwise, it's probably as good as anything else. I think something has to give. So maybe we just don't understand it well enough and we have surveillance occlusion rates. But I would say now that there's reasonable good observational evidence that for this kind of situation as these finds themselves, and you wouldn't expect it to happen.
So this model of Mitch Biegelman does not fit the data that we talked about, even if you solve the problems in theory.
You don't see this guy, you can't really look in and see what's happening. So I think his model is a spherical model where he shows that you can have radiation trapping, so the radiation is the material is falling in faster than the radiation is diffusing out. So you can write a 1D analytical solution for that. People have tried to simulate that. What normally happens is that you get all sorts of instabilities. A is settled into a disk, and the stuff goes out the other way, and you have photon bubble instabilities. And so people think that you can get mildly super-Eddington, but not dramatic. That would help somewhat. But It's one of the solutions you might take into account too, but as I said at the beginning.
So you can't have the radiation be emitted anisotropic?
So I thought people had talked about solutions like that to the Alexis or somehow.
Yeah,
I know they have. Radiation beamed or something like that, so you don't know. You're just overestimating the radiation pressure.
But we normally, they only believe in moderate super anything. The effect of super anything are not large.
Okay.
They're moderate, they're a few.
Okay, I think we better wind it up there. Martin's still around. You're welcome to ask him questions afterwards. Thanks.